Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's 3 minutes after 9 a.m., February 2nd, 2023. Me today is Co-Chair Senator Olson, Senator Bishop, Senator Merrick, Senator Wilson, Senator Keel. Senator Hoffman is away on other state business up north. He had to go to his fish camp. So today we're going to have the Department of Revenue Chief Economist, Mr. Dan Stickle, come forward and give us a presentation, and we're going to have a conversation on what we call the order of operations. And what we're going to talk about today is mainly the tax calculations and how monies flow through and are allocated out in our oil basins. And mainly we're going to look at what we normally refer to as north of 68, which is latitude 68. And that's Prudhoe Bay and Kuparik. That's where we generate about 46% of our revenue in the state. And the other big source is the permanent fund. But every year the department puts together what we call the revenue source book, and they put it together in the fall, and it is just that, sources of revenue. And the current edition is fall of 2022. So we'll be using that as a reference quite a bit as we walk through this. We have, on occasions here at the finance table, spent many days going into excruciating detail down in the weeds. And the presentation today is going to be higher level. It's probably not going to be overly simplistic if you haven't been exposed to this before, but it's going to be high level for the committee members, and we're going to do this intentionally today. We've got a lot of new members within the legislature and a lot of new staff. And before we drop into the deep weeds over the next couple months, we want to make sure that the elected officials and the employees, along with the public, can understand what we're talking about, or just gibberish and nobody understands what we're talking about, including most of us. So there'll be some high-level conversations, and I'd like to also take a little bit of time from time to time through the day to talk about some of the component parts within the revenue source book, because this committee has had some stuff added to it over the years, and we'll touch on that along the way. So we have had a good working relationship with the department for many years on this document, the revenue source book, and what we feel should be added to it, or maybe stated in a little different manner to make it a little easier to understand. And Mr. Stickle has been very involved for many years in this. So we're going to try not to let him get too deep in the weeds, because try to keep him up on the surface as he goes through this. And if we get into an area where we need to go into substantially more detail, we'll have that opportunity going forward. But a lot of the areas within here have been cleaned up through different statute changes, dealing with credits and other things over the last few years. So some of the complexity has been removed off of the out of the tax code. So all that being said, Mr. Stickle, if you could introduce yourself for the record, and then take us through your presentation, and maybe briefly give the public, because there's probably people that have never seen this before, maybe if it's even their first finance committee hearing, kind of explain to them your background, how long you've worked for the state, and what you do.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with the Alaska Department of Revenue. So in terms of my background, proud graduate of the University of Alaska. I joined the Department of Revenue in 2004 as a non-petroleum economist, moved into the oil and gas side of things. So I was around in Department of Revenue when we made the switch from a gross tax system known as the ELF to the PPT, which took effect in 2006, and then the ACEs, which took effect in 2007, and then the Senate Bill 21, which is the basis for the current tax regime, which took effect in 2013. And I've been serving as the chief economist with the department for the last 7 years now.
And you've been involved in this revenue source book in a fairly intimate way, is that correct?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. I've been involved in producing the book for almost 2 decades now.
Okay. So with that, we'll go ahead and do our standard presentation. We'll let you go through this one slide at a time. We'll ask questions, and then we'll try to fill in the gaps. And so at the end of the day, people understand hopefully what we're doing and why we're doing it.
Awesome. So thank you for the opportunity to present the order of operations presentation for our production tax. As you stated, Mr. Chairman, the purpose is to present a high-level overview of how our current oil and gas production tax system works for the North Slope, intended as a refresher for most of you on the committee, and then also as an introduction for folks watching at home who may be less familiar with the current tax system. So I'll start on slide 2 with a list of acronyms. I will try to limit my use of acronyms as much as possible. There are a lot of acronyms in the oil and gas industry and in our tax statute. So we put those, the acronyms that are used in the presentation are listed here as a reference to help as we go through the presentation. Slide 3 is the agenda. So the purpose of the presentation is really to explain the nuts and bolts of the current tax system, to look at what we have now and how it works. The intent is not to address the policy decisions around, you know, should we have what we have? Should we be looking at any potential changes? We'll start by looking at all of the sources of oil and gas revenue to the state. And then we will move into a detailed walkthrough of the production tax calculation in particular. The focus will be on North Slope oil. That's where we get the vast majority of our petroleum revenue. And slide 4, I'd like to make a disclaimer before I jump in. So we're taking a very complex tax system and we're distilling it down into easily understandable pieces. Note that we're working with aggregate data here, which won't exactly tie out to some of the detailed company-specific modeling that we use to produce the numbers in the revenue forecast, but the result is pretty close. When we're looking at actual taxes, those are, again, it's a company-specific calculation. Those are based on monthly and annual tax filings by the company. Those are subject to audit. Also want to note that I'm an economist. I'm not an auditor, so anything I say in this presentation should not be construed as an official tax interpretation or tax advice.
And now that you did the corporate disclaimer, just a little bit of background information. Tell us what a severance tax is, or if that's going to be covered in the next slide in more detail, or just the definition.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So a severance tax is any tax that's levied by a sovereign on the severing of resources within the jurisdiction of the sovereign. So an example would be when a company, if a mining company is to take gold out of the ground, the sovereign could levy a tax on the severing of that resource. In terms of oil and gas, severance taxes are common for the production of oil and gas. We call our tax a production tax. That is the state's severance tax on oil and gas.
And then put a little bit more focus on the aggregated data that we use to set policy versus the individual company data, and why, if we had three companies, one might come in and say, this is good for me, one might come in and say, I'm neutral, and one might come in and say, the world's going to end tomorrow if you implement this.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So we are prohibited by statute from disclosing any information that would allow the members of the public or the legislature to understand the particulars of a tax return. So we can't provide information from one specific field or one specific company. When we produce this presentation, we are aggregating multiple companies and multiple fields together. Each field and each company has a unique economic situation. So they'll have unique costs of doing business. They'll have unique production profiles. They'll have unique plans in terms of how Alaska fits into their overall corporate business. It's definitely the case that some companies may have a higher or lower cost structure, and a certain element of the tax system could impact different companies differently.
Right, or may have an area that's not subject to it, it's not applicable to them, and it makes it challenging for the policymakers, which is us, to hit the spot as accurately as we'd like, because we have, as you had mentioned, multiple companies with different structures, different hurdle rates, different cost exposures, and we have to have a policy that fits everybody. And we really don't know how it fits each individual company unless they are more specific and voluntarily tell us. So that's why sometimes we have different viewpoints expressed by the companies or their representatives when we're trying to put a policy together. So that's something that is easily missed or not recognized by the public when we struggle with setting the policies. And there's any other questions, and we'll go on to the... Oh, I want to make one other quick point, one other issue out, and that's on the first bullet. We've had multiple consultants, and we've heard in numerous other meetings outside of Alaska, Alaska has one of the most complex oil tax structures on the planet. We've even had consultants tell us they thought it was the most complex. So we have historic contractual arrangements with the industry that go back to opening up the basins in the 60s that are royalties that aren't going to get changed. And we've got changing economics along the lines of, you know, through the decades. So we have, and we started with a gross tax. Now we're in a net tax, so we got this hybrid blend of multiple decades and contracts and different structures. So we have lots of moving parts. And I think most people would agree the complexity, it would be nicer if it wasn't so complex. So just for those watching at home, we have, if not the most complex structure of all the oil basins on the planet, we're in the running for first place. That's not necessarily good, by the way, but it's the way it is. And we'll go to slide 5.
So slide 5 gives an overview of the 4 major revenue sources by which the state receives revenue from oil and gas production in the state. So there's a royalty that's levied. The royalty is received for any production on state-owned land. We also receive a share of royalty received from production on federal land. We have the corporate income tax. The corporate income tax applies to most, but not all, companies doing business in the state. That tax is, for oil and gas, is based on worldwide income as apportioned to Alaska. We have a property tax, which applies to all oil and gas property anywhere in the state and within the state's 3-mile limit. And then we have the production tax, which is the state's severance tax on oil and gas, which applies to all production anywhere in the state and within the 3-mile offshore limit.
So when we're looking at our revenue off of our oil basin, we have to add these four components together. And sometimes there's presentations that may omit one or two of them. So we always have to be on guard that if we're looking at the entirety of the basin, we have all four components added together. Some of these components, as mentioned, when you have a property tax, don't all go to the state. Sometimes they go to the borough. But when we look at the tax structure, we have to add them together and look at, even though we, the state, don't receive the money, it still count when we look at the sharing relationship with the industry as our side of the table or the government share or the government portion. Also, we need to take into account the reduction in royalties, because not all royalties are the same. Like all gas isn't the same. Some of the older royalties are at 12.5. The newer ones are at 16.67. And then we have some offsets that we'll get into that in a little while, affecting royalties. And even though we may have a royalty rate set, there's still some of those monies that don't come to the state. They may go to the communities. Not too dissimilar from property tax. So we'll go on to the next slide.
All right, Mr. Chairman, slide 6 is a comparison of 5 years of state revenue from oil and gas. We have historical information for fiscal years 21 and 22, and then the current year, which is fiscal year 2023, which is partially complete, and then 2 years of forecast data for fiscal year 2024 and 2025. The property tax revenue shown here is only the state share. As you mentioned, the municipalities also receive a significant share of property tax revenue. It was about $450 million in the most recent year to municipalities. We have the corporate income tax, which applies to the C corporations doing business in the state. You see in fiscal year 2021, we actually had a negative revenue for corporate tax, which was net refunds paid out. That had to do with some COVID relief provisions whereby companies were allowed to receive refunds for some prior year taxes paid when they had large losses in 2020 due to low oil prices. We are expecting those revenues did rebound in fiscal year 2022, and we're expecting robust corporate tax revenue for the next several years. We have the production tax, which will be the focus of the rest of this presentation, so we'll be getting into a lot of detail there. And then in terms of royalties, this includes bonuses, rents, and royalties. Also includes both the share that goes to the general fund as well as a share of royalties that is dedicated to the permanent fund and the school fund. The final two oil and gas revenue sources are any settlements based on assessments or disputes of prior year production tax, royalty, or other mineral taxes or levies. Those are dedicated to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. And then finally, the federal government shares half of revenue received for royalties and related levies in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, or the NPRA. The revenue from the NPRA is expected to increase in this forecast as we have greater production from the Greater Moose's Tooth Unit, which was the first major development in that area. And then beyond the time horizon of this slide, the Willow development would also be in the NPRA and would contribute to this shared revenue.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, can you talk about how those decisions got made on the corporate income tax refunds?
Sure. Senator Keel, through the chair. So Alaska maintains what's known as rolling conformity with the federal income tax code. So we adopt by reference many provisions of federal income tax code. And so when the federal government makes a change to corporate income taxes, we automatically adopt those into our state income tax unless the legislature explicitly chooses to opt out. And so what happened in the CARES Act with COVID is the federal government enacted a relief provision for companies whereby if they had a net operating loss in 2018, 2019, or 2020, they could carry back that net operating loss up to 5 years and receive a refund for prior year taxes paid. And given our role in conformity, we automatically adopted that provision into state law. And so that generated some significant refunds for the oil and gas industry that were paid out in fiscal year 2021 and also 2022.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's valuable for Alaskans to know that while the state was dipping into savings and having trouble with some of our programs, we weren't actively making decisions to go cut a bunch of checks back to folks who had otherwise been taxpayers. It's a downside of one simple provision in our complex code is that we don't necessarily make all the decisions.
I got a couple of follow-ups on the subject while we're on the corporate tax, and then maybe better now or later, Mr. Stickle, I'll let you make that decision in your presentation. But first one is just a little bit more of a comment on the subject matter of the tax or the tax change that allow a look back and a restating of their taxes. That was nationwide, wasn't isolated to just the oil industry. So they were a participant in a much bigger thought process and targeted industry. It's unfortunate for us that, you know, when they got to do the deductions, it went negative. It's always nice if something happens and it goes positive for us too. That's the way it goes. But with that, I'd like you to help us a little bit. You know, we set up the structure, the four major areas that we collect revenue off of our oil basin, the severance, the royalties, property tax, and income tax. But the income tax was set up, that portion was set up with three major corporations that were all C Corps. And since then, one of the C Corps has withdrawn from the state and sold their interest to a S Corp, which is taxed at personal rates, not corporate income tax rate. And we don't have a personal tax. And that leaves, some would call it a distortion within the sharing relationship and or at least a change in the numerics. And can you help us with that and what that marginal change was or is? And in doing so, if you, I don't know how you, well, in doing so, there's FY23, which is a positive number of 390, mainly by two participants. I don't know how you deal with 21, which is a negative number. So can you help the committee understand the dollar magnitude of what we're dealing with and then the time horizon in which this has taken place and maybe the aggregate?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So the corporate income tax applies to C corporations. And currently, a little over two-thirds of production comes from C corporations. So a little less than one-third of the production in the state is coming from companies that are not subject to the corporate income tax. If you assumed that the corporate income tax we're forecasting for C corporations would scale up with production, then expanding the corporate income tax to all oil and gas companies would generate a little over $100 million of incremental revenue per year. Obviously, the exact number would depend on the specific tax details of those companies that would get added to the tax.
Okay, and then if you're not prepared, you always get back to us. So I see there's Ms. Colleen Glover online from the tax division. She might be able to help. But I mean, what's the aggregate impact to us, the state, on the subject?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So the aggregate impact is going to be a little over $100 million per year of potentially foregone corporate income tax revenue.
Okay, so has this gone on for 50 years or 20 years or 5 years?
So, Mr. Chairman, without getting into specifics of individual taxpayers, historically, a much larger portion of production and industry activity was made up by C corporations who were subject to the corporate income tax. Over the last several years, with some of the transactions that have happened in the industry, that share has dropped, and it's now in the two-thirds to about 70% of production is coming from the C corporations.
Okay, so you can get, the department can get back to us on the estimate of the impact, but that's on one side of that equation. The other side of the equation is the increase in production that's taken place. So let's not recognize that when we get into the equation here or the issue here, that there's been a change, and we see that in the production numbers. Anyway, we'll let you get back to the committee on that, because it's a point that's brought up time and time again. We just need to keep track of it. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickel, foreshadowing, you'll talk later about differences between oil that's found under state and federal and other land. Any difference in corporate income tax with regard to where the oil is found, or is that paid regardless?
Sure. Senator Keel, through the chair. So for property tax, corporate tax, and production tax, basically all of the taxes, those apply the same to any production on state land and within the state's three-mile limit. It's once you get into the royalty provisions that there's significant differences depending on where the oil is produced. And I do have a slide towards the end of the presentation that'll get into that in more detail.
Okay. You have any other questions on this? We'll go on to the next slide.
All right, so slide 7 is just an illustration of the high-level order of operations within the fiscal system as a whole. So royalties come off the top. The landowner is entitled to compensation for their share of the oil and gas production before any taxes are applied. Then the property tax for upstream property, those are considered lease expenditures for the production tax. So we look at the property tax before jumping into the production tax. Those property taxes are also deductible against corporate income taxes. Third, we have the production tax, which is what we're looking at for most of the presentation here. That comes after subtracting royalties, after allowing for property taxes, which are deductible in the production tax calculation, but before corporate income taxes. The production tax is a deductible expense for purposes of calculating that worldwide taxable income that is the basis for corporate income taxes. And then finally, the state corporate income tax becomes a deduction against the federal corporate income tax. So that federal corporate income tax is really the very last piece of the fiscal system.
We have any questions on this one? So let's go touch on the double deduction subject. You've got corporate income tax, where you have your standard IRS code and you're depreciating and deducting and amortizing expenditures. And then you have the production tax, which will deduct a lot of similar expenditures against the production tax. So help the public understand why this is standard procedure. This is not isolated to Alaska. This is the way the structure works. Why these deductions are allowed in both categories?
Sure. So, Mr. Chairman, for the production tax, an expenditure is allowed to be deducted in calculating the net production tax, which we'll get into in a couple of slides. That's a fairly standard provision of of any fiscal systems around the world that look at net profits is allowing a company to recoup their costs of operation. For the corporate income tax, those expenditures would also factor into calculation of their worldwide income. So there would be a very, depending on how big the company is worldwide, it would have an impact on their worldwide income also, which then gets apportioned to Alaska for purposes of the corporate income tax. Again, the way our corporate income tax is structured, that's also fairly consistent with how other states structure corporate income tax.
Right, and then, because this subject does come up quite often when you're newly introduced to the subject matter of why there's what would appear to be double deductions, and there's really not. They're two totally separate and distinct things, a corporate income tax and a severance tax. So maybe highlight why it's important to allow deductions on the production tax and the timing of those deductions. And maybe I'm getting a little too far afield here, but it's tied in to the investment decision.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So the production tax overall was developed as a net profits tax. And so the deduction of costs, the establishment of the tax rate and the various provisions, these were all kind of developed together with the deduction of costs being an integral part of the fiscal system. From a company's perspective, they're looking at their ability to recoup costs and make a profit on their investment. So the ability to realize credit for any of those expenditures that they've made is important to the company.
Okay, so because we're going to get into the credit conversation, so we want to be careful to use the word credit because it'll get confusing. The deductions, and if they're not allowed to have deductions, capital and expenditure deductions against the production tax, their economics go upside down. It's not too dissimilar from buying an apartment complex and then you can't depreciate it. It would totally turn the economics upside down on that because your entire gross revenue would be subject to the tax. And that's not the way the tax system is structured. So it's important that they're allowed to deduct them, and that's standard around the world. We get into a discussion here at the table, do we want to allow quicker deductions or slower deductions? And if you have quicker deductions, that means there's a stronger cash flow coming to the investor or the producer more immediate than later, and it makes their could possibly turn a marginal field into a positive field as far as the investment decision. If we want to slow it down, we extend their deductions out in time. So when we get into the tax structure, we spend a lot of time on just an effort on how quick is the allowed deductions or cash flow allowed to come in. And you can speed it up or slow it down. And when you slow it down, it hurts the economic return on a project, and when you speed it up, it improves it. So it's just it's kind of like stepping on the throttle. That's a concept and a discussion that sometimes when you first start into this, and if you're not very familiar with the investment world, it's kind of abstract. But we've had many presentations here that folks can go back and look from consultants from both the industry and us on that very thing, changing the timing of cash flow. So it's very, very critical. And just one other quick comment on that. When we went from a gross tax to a net tax, the net tax allowed us to accelerate some of the deductions and skew the rates of return, making it more favorable for marginal fields as our basin got older to get to the marginal fields. Otherwise, they won't drill them because they're not economic. So we've got some of these, I guess, every time we make a change in our structure, we have all these levers that move and things change. So we have to be careful when and what lever we're pushing or pulling. Sometimes there's reactions that we don't anticipate, and we spend the next couple of years trying to fix them. So that probably more detail than you wanted on the slide, Mr. Stickle, but I think it's an important concept that for the groundwork that we understand timing of cash flow is a lot of what we're going to be doing here in the next few minutes.
Sure, and Mr. Chairman, just to agree with one of the statements that you made, which is a semantic point, companies are able to recoup their costs through a deduction as opposed to a credit. Those are two terms that get thrown around. The legislature took action a few years back to eliminate the capital expenditure credits and the various net operating loss credits, and has replaced those with deductions.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, on your comment, they can still deduct their credits, their capital credits, we're just not going to get paid cash for them.
Senator Bishop, through the chair, that's correct. So for any credits that were earned prior to this 2016-2017 timeframe when we made these changes to the law, if a company still has those credits outstanding, they can still apply those against the tax calculation. What's changed is now if you have a loss or excess lease expenditures, those become a deduction that you can carry forward as opposed to a tax credit. And correct, those are no longer available for any state purchase. You have to use those against a tax liability.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Stickle.
Any other questions on the slide? Okay, we'll go on to slide 8.
All right, slide 8 is where the fun begins. So this table has a lot going on, and we'll spend a series of slides walking through this table piece by piece. This is based on the income statement that's included in Appendix E of the Fall 2022 Revenue Sources Book. I do want to note one revision we made. The original Revenue Sources Book version incorrectly calculated this appendix based on a 365-day year. Fiscal year 2024 will be a leap year. So we've since corrected the online version of the Revenue Sources Book and the slide here to correctly represent the 366 days that there will be in fiscal year 2024. So what this slide does is we walk through an illustration of that year's production tax calculation step by step. The focus is on the North Slope oil tax calculation, as that's where the vast majority of production and revenue is for the production tax. We start with our fall 2022 forecast of $81 per barrel and our production forecast of 503,700 barrels per day of production. That generates a daily value of production of about $41 million per day is the value of the oil produced on the slope, and an annual value of about just under $15 billion of oil. And so the next several slides, the focus is on taking that just under $15 billion of oil and looking at how that is split between the various cost centers and how we apply our tax to it.
Okay, and just a couple comments on this slide. Many years ago, when we were working on this, the Finance Committee had some difficulty because there was a debate within the Department of Revenue at the time. Should the Finance Committee be looking at just the revenue that we have at our disposal to deal with our budget? Or should we be looking at the revenue in total and then boil it down to what we have for our budget? So we worked through those issues, and and we agreed that we're going to look at the total pie, and then we're going to go down from there. We're not interested in just seeing what we have at our disposal in a given budget year. We want to look at the total revenue and where it all goes for the state, including our basin. So we worked through those, and then it was a rather surprise, I think, to some people dealing with the size of the basin and the magnitude of what we're dealing with. And then we also set forth, the committee did, and laid out an income form statement, an income statement style format, I should say, to help people understand this process. And we worked with that, and the Department of Revenue worked with us. And then they evolved that somewhat and made some changes in a little order, and refined it, tuned it up, made it better. And that has led to the last several pages in the revenue source book, where you see the income style statement for the current year and the next year, roughly, or sometimes they do 3 years. And then today in front of us, we have the statement that's also had some improvements, and I just want to call those out to Mr. Stickle and thank him on the value, the column on the far right, where the minimum tax floor, which we'll get into in a bit, and then the net tax, two separate calculations depending on what you fall under, is put in columns to make it delineated a little easier, so people recognize that when you get to that point, you have two paths to go down, one of which you're going to go down and one of which you're not. And then to turn the negative numbers red and put brackets on them to make it even easier to see. So I'd just like to thank the department for continually evolving the statement to make it easier and easier for members of the building and the workers and the public to quickly grasp, you know, the very high level of what we're doing. So this has been a work in progress for probably 15 years. It's been quite a while. And it'll continue to evolve as we recognize, you know, little different things here and there. So I would like to just thank the department for working with the committee throughout these years as we work through this complicated structure to try to make it easily understandable, at least at a higher level, to as many people as possible, including myself.
So, appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah. So slide nine, I'm getting ahead of myself. We'll start by walking through the income statement. We start at the top. The first step of the income statement is the calculation of royalty and taxable barrels. So any royalty barrels are deducted regardless of the ownership. Typical rates are 1/8, which is a 12.5% royalty that applies to a lot of the older fields, and then newer fields, a typical rate is 1/6 or 16.67%, but rates do vary across fields. Any federal and private land royalty is also deducted from the tax calculation in addition to royalty for state-owned land. We also subtract any barrels that are not subject to tax due to being outside the state's three-mile limit. Currently, this would include a small portion of the production from the North Star field. A field such as the Liberty development would also apply to that category as well and would not be subject to state production tax. And so after subtracting royalties, we arrive at taxable barrels. And we, for fiscal year 2024, we're estimating 161 million taxable barrels for a total value of $13 billion.
Okay.
The next step on slide 10 is the calculation of gross value at point of production, also known as the wellhead value. This is the basis for the start of both our production tax calculation as well as the start of the royalty calculation. To arrive at the gross value at point of production, we take the taxable production and then also subtract netback costs or transportation costs. So we take the $81 per barrel, which is received for the sale of the oil on the West Coast, that's priced in Long Beach, California. And then we deduct all of the relevant transportation costs. This would be marine transportation costs for getting the oil from Valdez to market. This would be the Trans-Alaska Pipeline tariff for getting the oil from the North Slope to Valdez. This would be any feeder pipeline tariffs for getting oil from outlying fields to pump station one of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. We have quality bank adjustments to adjust for various qualities of oil from the different fields, and some other minor adjustments. And those all lump into that that transportation cost estimated at $9.37 per barrel, but adding up to about $1.5 billion of total transportation cost in fiscal year 2024. And so the average gross value at point of production is about $71.63 per barrel, totaling about $11.5 billion for fiscal year 2024.
Maybe, okay, Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question sort of on the sort of TAPS. And I think the rate of return is almost about 10.8%. And the owners have a part of the settlement have the opportunity to change that rate. Have there been any talks about wanting to change that rate of return for the TAPS?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, I'm not prepared to speak to that. Be happy to get back to you on that.
Thank you.
So the question was the tariff on TAPS. Okay. So maybe we can go into that, get back to some more detail on this question, but maybe for the public, just touch on why it's important that we have more throughput in the pipeline and transport than less on our costs. For as an example, when we get into a field like Willow, that we may not have the royalties coming to the treasury that we otherwise would have, but there's still additive benefits regardless of that. Dealing with the efficiency of the pipe transportation system or the oil transportation system?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So for operation of an oil pipeline, generally speaking, the way the per barrel cost is calculated is you look at the total cost of operating that pipeline, which includes includes an allowance for rate of return, as Senator Wilson mentioned. And you take that total cost of operating the pipeline and you divide it by the number of barrels going through the pipeline to arrive at a per barrel tariff. If you have a fixed asset like the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with a fairly stable operation cost, as you have increasing oil production, you'll divide that fairly stable cost over a higher number of barrels, which gives you a smaller per barrel amount, and vice versa. If you have lower production, you're going to have a higher per barrel cost. So having more oil in the pipeline actually reduces the average transportation cost for all barrels from all fields.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickel, I wanted to get it on the last slide, but we used to have in the revenue sources book when you were talking about the royalty, the 12.5% and the 16%. And you mentioned it on older fields, but there used to be a footnote in here, and I haven't found it yet. But you broke it out by year for historical purposes, you know, for those listeners at home. And it was, you know, from discovery till about 1977 or 78, we were at the 12.5, and then post, we were at the 16. Can you find that and just send it to the committee that split on the royalties?
Sure, Senator Bishop.
The timeline.
Through the chair, we'd be happy to work with Department of Natural Resources to provide information about the royalties by field.
Thank you.
Go on to the next slide, please.
So moving on from the calculation of gross value at point of production, the next step on slide 11 is looking at lease expenditures. So the production taxes, it's essentially a modified version of a net profits tax. For capital expenditures, we do allow the companies to deduct the entire value of the capital expenditure in the year incurred. There's no depreciation schedule around that. In terms of defining capital expenditures, we use Internal Revenue Service, IRS guidelines in general to define what represents a capital expenditure. Basically, anything that's not a capital expenditure that's an allowable expense is considered an operating expenditure. Generally, those are the ongoing costs of operations and labor. There's two terms to understand. One is allowable lease expenditures. Capital and operating expenditures, collectively we refer to those as lease expenditures. And then there's allowable lease expenditures and deductible lease expenditures. Allowable lease expenditures are going to be any of the capital and operating costs in the unit that are directly associated with producing the oil. This includes most of the costs of doing business on the slope. Not everything is allowable. So some examples of non-allowable costs include financing costs, the costs of acquiring the lease, any dispute resolution costs, dismantlement, removal, and restoration at the end of field life. Those are all examples of some costs that are not allowable lease expenditures. And then deductible lease expenditures, which is what we're showing on the slide here. This is a term of art that we've developed in Department of Revenue. It's not in a statute or regulation, but we use this to look at that portion of the allowable lease expenditures that are applied in the tax calculation in the given year, up to the gross value at point of production. And then non-deductible lease expenditures are any allowable lease expenditures above and beyond the value of the oil produced. Generally speaking, the deductible lease expenditures are going to represent spending by incumbent producers. And generally speaking, the non-deductible lease expenditures represent primarily spending by companies that are involved in exploration and development with little to no current production. At the bottom of the slide 11, we have a line here, which is net new lease expenditures earned and carried forward. So any of those non-deductible lease expenditures, those expenses above and beyond what can be deducted in the current year tax calculation, those turn into a carried forward lease expenditure, which can be used to reduce future year taxes those can become a deduction in a future year, assuming that the company has sufficient production and gross value in that future year.
Yes, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, that sounds like a significant difference in how this tax system treats a new explorer versus a longtime producer. The chairman talked about turning levers and how fast a company can reduce it or recoup its investment. It sounds maybe you could talk a little bit about how carrying forward until someday you've got oil production and profitable oil production before you can start to recoup that. How does that compare to somebody who's got production from other fields?
Sure. Senator Keel, through the chair. So in terms of when the company realizes the benefit of the investment that they're making, for a current producer, if they have sufficient production elsewhere on the slope, they would recognize the benefit of any spending in the year that they make the spending. Whereas for a new company that receives these carried forward lease expenditures, they would potentially receive benefit for that spending at some year in the future. So in that way, the system does favor spending by incumbent producers.
Follow up.
Thank you. So, if memory serves, we tried to level that out by paying those as cash, and we called those credits, and that got away from us. We've gotten away from doing that. What would be other levers that might let us equalize how we treat a longtime producer and a new explorer?
Sure, Senator Keel. So there's, through the chair, so there's many levers. You can look at all of these elements of the tax calculation that we're looking at here. One other provision of these carried forward lease expenditures is the way it currently works is you earn the carried forward lease expenditure, and that expenditure maintains its value in nominal terms until the 8th or 11th year after the expenditure is earned. We actually decrease the value of those lease expenditures. So they degrade in value. Something that a lot of other jurisdictions do is they actually apply an uplift to lease expenditures, which increases the value over time and is intended to compensate for that time value of money impact. That would be just not making a policy recommendation, but that would be one potential lever that could be looked at.
So let's just stop there for a minute, because you threw out a term that, you know, we use from time to time, but an uplift, that's not going for an elevator ride. Explain uplifts a little bit to the committee.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So I'll explain using an example. So let's say a company spends $100 million this year and doesn't have a tax liability to apply that. If you were to have a 10% uplift, then at the end of the year, that $100 million would become worth $110 million against the next year's taxes. And the year after that, it would become worth $121 million and so on. So that's a mechanism that's used in certain other jurisdictions.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the other possibility is we could limit a deduction for a lease expenditure to just be applicable to the field it's spent in, right? I mean, then you got a new explorer who doesn't have any production, and someone with legacy production is out exploring, they're going to get the same treatment.
Senator Keel, through the chair, so there would be different options we could look at as far as, you know, where you apply what's known as a ring fence. So currently we have a ring fence for the entire North Slope. So an expenditure that's earned on the North Slope can be applied against any production anywhere within the North Slope. Potentially expanding or contracting that would be one policy lever that the legislature could look at.
Thank you.
Another ring fence term that's used when we get into the tax structure. So maybe touch bases on what a ring fence is. It's not a bull ring, but.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So the term ring fence is, for accounting purposes, what geography do we look at when we're calculating the tax? So if we had a statewide ring fence, for example, then a company would look at all of their production and all of their spending anywhere in the state in calculating this tax liability. For North Slope, we have a North Slope wide ring fence. So a company looks at all of their production on the North Slope, all of their spending on the North Slope to calculate their North Slope tax. A company that does business in multiple areas of the state, for instance, would not include Cook Inlet production in their North Slope ring fence tax. Other ways you can structure a tax would be to do a ring fence on a field specific basis, which is what we do in the Cook Inlet region, which is not the focus of this presentation, but that's a term you'll hear tossed about when talking about Cook Inlet.
So if I could just add to Senator Keel's question a little bit, and one of the challenges we have here, if you have a development and you ring fence it and the industry's perking away inside that ring fence and there's a new entrant that's outside the ring fence, or the company wants to go outside the ring fence, the company that's inside the ring fence can't take their expenditures or their revenue, I should say, and expenditures from the ring fence, inside the ring fence, and take the external development cost and deduct it immediately, which gives them, one would argue, maybe an economic advantage over somebody to develop a field outside the ring fence. That somebody's going to develop a new field outside the ring fence that doesn't have any revenue. All he has is expenses going out, nothing coming in. But we have to do a pooled tax. We have trouble bifurcating some of that stuff and targeting it. And we've had numerous discussions of ring fencing the North Slope. There's a lot of positives and negatives, but it changes the economics on marginal fields for existing developers also. So it gets into the weeds a little bit, Senator Keel, but definitely the ring fencing is a tool that could be a double-edged sword depending on what policy you want to try to encourage. But again, we want to remember that all these mechanisms fundamentally is changing the timing of cash flow, including an uplift. If you add the deduction or cap a deduction, we're changing cash flow timing. Comes, frankly, down to the money. I hate to say it, but this is a money committee. And that's the key. Watch the cash. So we'll probably have some more of these discussions sometime on those things, but ring fencing is a tool. Go ahead.
Another different topic on this slide, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Stickle, so the lease expenditures are one of the bigger numbers on the slide, and that's perfectly appropriate, right? Costs a lot of money. Alaskans often have questions about how this works, and as we've been exploring today, it's a complex system. How much transparency is there in what Alaskans can see in these, what's deductible on the slope, and how does that compare to what Alaskans can see, or excuse me, what a citizen could see in other jurisdictions? Are we roughly comparable?
Sure. Senator Keel, through the chair, in terms of what we can release, we are limited by taxpayer confidentiality. So we can't release specific information specific to a single taxpayer. We do provide as much information as we can in the revenue sources book. Appendix D has a 10-year history and a 10-year forecast of lease expenditures broken out by North Slope versus non-North Slope. And then even within the North Slope, we add a further granularity to look at those fields eligible for gross value reduction versus other fields. And the gross value reduction, we'll define what that means later on in the presentation. We've provided to the committee information breaking out that 10-year history and 10-year forecast between the total allowable lease expenditures and the deductible lease expenditures. So we're being as transparent as we can given the statutes around that.
So let me try to help a little bit with that, just from being in the weeds of this deeper than I'd like to be. To try to separate what's operating and what's capital, what's deductible and what's not, we could have set up in our own statutes classifications for that. And that becomes complicated. So what we've done is we've basically adopted the IRS interpretation of operating and capital. And that's been flushed through the courts and it's fairly well defined. And then we have another list of exclusions that's in the tax code, which is like you can't deduct a marble countertop in some, you know, bathroom in Houston. Stuff like that. And you've mentioned, Mr. Stickle had mentioned other deductions that are the more obvious ones, but we've tried to list some of those that are outside the normal IRS definition. But by relying on the IRS definition, we avoid all kinds of debates and disagreements and litigation. So the more we can rely on those definitions, the smoother things are. Between the sovereign and the industries, trying to define what those are. Does that help at all? A little bit why we have it structured the way we do? Or?
It does, Mr. Chairman. I guess the second half of the question, just roughly comparable levels of confidentiality and disclosure to other states or other major oil provinces?
Sure, Senator Keel, through the chair. So in terms of our tax confidentiality, that's pretty standard across different states to hold taxpayer information confidential. Looking at lease expenditures in particular, Alaska is fairly unique in the United States in having a net profits-based tax system. So a lot of the other states, if they're looking primarily at gross value of oil, they're not collecting information about lease expenditures to begin with. So in comparison to one of those states, the fact that we're collecting and reporting any information is actually providing more information than you have in some of the other states.
Okay, but let's add a little bit there, because we are just definitely distinctly different. The state of Alaska is the only state that owns a subsurface, pretty much. In Texas, it's owned by, you know, the farmer or the ranchers, and in a simplistic term, in North Dakota, by the farmers. That's why they don't have this type of structure. We're more similar to Alberta. So we are different than the other states that have no reason to be interested in the stuff as much detail as we are. So they'll never replicate the states of Alaska's tax system because they don't own the resource. The state doesn't. So I just thought I'd add that because it's when we compare, you got to be careful who we're comparing it to. And even when you compare the tax structure to us in North Dakota or us in Texas, you got to account for the difference of who owns it. And you got to account for the subsurface owner, not just the surface owner. Do we have other questions on this one?
Okay.
Next slide.
All right, so once we've calculated the lease expenditures, we get to calculate the production tax value on slide 12, also abbreviated as PTV. Production tax value is gross value at point of production, less allowable lease or less deductible lease expenditures. It's basically our version of a net profit calculation, with that exception that we allow for immediate expensing of immediate deduction of capital expenditures. So each company calculates their own production tax value based on all of their North Slope activity, including all of their fields and developments on the North Slope. And that production tax value is essentially, it's the tax base for the production taxes and net profits tax system. This production tax value is also what we in Department of Revenue will reference when we're looking at effective tax rates, when we're looking at how the profit is distributed between federal government, state government, and producer. For fiscal year 2024, we are estimating a production tax value of $44.10 per barrel on average, with a total production tax value of about $7.1 billion for the year.
Any questions on this? Okay. Now we hit the road sign. We're going to go left or right. And trying to make it not so dry in here so we all go to sleep, but we're going to make a decision here whether to have minimum or net tax, correct?
Yes, sir. So on slide 13, we move into the tax calculation. And for illustrative purposes, we show this as two parallel tax calculations done side by side, with the tax due being the higher of. In statutory terms, the minimum tax floor, it's not a true tax levy, it's a tax floor calculation, but it does help to show them side by side for understanding here. The minimum tax floor is 4% of gross value at point of production. Anytime the annual oil price is greater than $25 per barrel, so hopefully that is the rate that will always be in place. There are lower minimum tax floor rates that would be in place if the annual oil price was less than $25 per barrel for Alaska North Slope oil. Using that 4% rate, the applied to the gross value at point of production of $11.5 billion yields a minimum tax floor of about $460 million for fiscal year 2024.
Questions on the minimum? Senator Bishop.
Mr. Stickle, did we hit the minimum for a period of time in 21, fiscal year 2021?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, in fiscal year 2021, there were some companies that were paying at the minimum tax, as I'll show on an upcoming slide.
Thank you.
The total receipts were actually a little bit above the minimum tax, so in aggregate, we were still under a net tax system in 2021.
Thank you.
And just as a footnote on that, let's remember that we're dealing with consolidated data, and under his last comment, in that year, some companies were in the minimum tax, some were in the net profits tax, and then we have to blend it together and make policy decisions. So just an added complication that we have to deal with.
Sure. And Mr. Chairman, so generally it's in this range of between about $50 and $70 per barrel is when companies start to move off of that minimum tax. So then slide 14 is the other half of the side-by-side tax calculation. And this is the more complex side. We have the net, so we show the net calculation, and we also show the gross value reduction. Spend a little bit of time on this gross value reduction. So that's an incentive for new development. It's a temporary benefit for qualifying oil from qualifying new field developments. What the gross value reduction does is it allows a company to exclude either 20 or 30% of the gross value for qualifying fields from their production tax value calculation. And what that does is it reduces the tax base for their net tax calculation. The 20% applies for any qualifying new fields. The 30% gross value reduction is a higher rate that applies for fields comprised exclusively of state-owned leases with greater than a 12.5% royalty. So these are going to be some of the more newly issued leases, if those are located entirely on state-owned leases, state-issued leases. Another provision of the gross value reduction is once we get into the tax credits, any gross value reduction eligible field receives a flat $5 per barrel tax credit, as opposed to a sliding scale credit that applies to other production. And then the flat $5 per barrel per taxable barrel credit can be applied to reduce tax liability below the minimum tax if companies don't also take sliding scale credits. So a little bit of complexity there, but just to understand where that gross value reduction number is coming from. And it is a temporary benefit, so the gross value reduction benefit expires after 7 years of production or after any 3 years in which Alaska North Slope oil prices average greater than $70 per barrel.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, can you give us, without getting super deep, can you give us a sense of how broad or how narrow that new oil definition is?
Sure, Senator Keel, through the chair. So this is going to apply to qualifying new producing areas or new fields. There's also a provision for an expansion of an existing producing area. But essentially, any of the major new developments that you see on the slope would potentially qualify for the gross value reduction for a temporary period.
Just to follow up, so that could be within some of our legacy fields.
Senator Keel, through the chair, so a new producing area within a legacy field or potentially an expansion of an existing producing area could qualify.
Thanks.
Any other questions on this one? Okay. Go ahead and continue.
All right. So once we've come up with the gross value reduction here, and you see we're estimating about $146 million reduction to production tax value in fiscal year 2024. Then the net tax is based on that production tax value after the gross value reduction multiplied times the 35% statutory tax rate, which gets us a tax before credits of about $2.4 billion for fiscal year 2024. We compare this net tax calculation to the minimum tax floor, and we take the higher of. In this case, the $2.4 billion is much higher than the minimum tax floor, and so that becomes our production tax before application of credits.
Okay. Go ahead.
And slide 15 starts to look at these credits. There are current statute, there are two primary credits. These are the per taxable barrel credits. There's one credit for gross value reduction eligible oil, and then there's another for all other oil. The vast majority of production and the vast majority of credits are actually in that non-gross value reduction category, and that's expected to remain the case going forward, given that the gross value reduction is a temporary benefit. As you proceed in time, the fields that are currently receiving that benefit will graduate into the no longer receiving that benefit at the same time as you have potentially new fields receiving the gross value reduction. So for non-gross value reduction production, we have a sliding scale per taxable barrel credit. The sliding scale credit is $8 per taxable barrel when the wellhead value of the oil is less than $80 per barrel. And it decreases in $10 increments of wellhead value until you reach a wellhead value of greater than $150 per taxable barrel when the sliding scale credit reduces to zero. That sliding scale credit cannot be used to reduce the tax below the minimum tax floor. And if a company chooses to apply that credit, they can't use any other credits or deductions to reduce their tax below their company's minimum tax floor. For the production that is eligible for the gross value reduction, we have a flat $5 per taxable barrel credit. There's no sliding scale for the gross value reduction eligible oil. If a company does not take sliding scale credit, they can use that $5 per barrel credit to reduce their tax liability below the minimum tax floor, potentially all the way to zero. Looking at these per taxable barrel credits, they're different from some of the credits the state has had in the past in that any per barrel credits not used in the year that they're earned are forfeit. There's no carrying forward of these credits. There's no cash value above using them in the tax calculation. There's no refunding of the tax credits. We have a small amount of other tax credits against liability. We're showing this is about $0.7 million in fiscal year 2024. This represents primarily small producer credits. We do have a couple of companies on the slope with relatively small amounts of production that are able to apply a small amount of these credits against their tax liability. We're not forecasting any other prior year credits. So in the forecast, any of the capital expenditure and net operating loss credits that existed from several years back when we allowed those to be earned, we're anticipating that any remaining value of those will be applied in fiscal year 2023. So we're not showing any of those in the 2024 tax calculation.
Can you help? Wait a minute, we have a question from Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, just for illustrative purposes, the small producer credits, those several, I believe you identified, what is their production per day or annually to what? Are we talking people that are under 10,000 barrels a day? Just for those that might be listening at home.
Sure, Senator Bishop, through the chair. So the small producer credit was available for companies with under 100,000 barrels per day of production. So it actually, there's actually a, it was up to 12, if you had under 50,000 barrels per day of production, it's a $12 million per year maximum credit. And once you reach 100,000 barrels per day of production, it reduces to zero on a linear basis. And that credit has been phased out for new entrants. And is so over the next couple years, that credit is being completely phased out.
Thank you.
And then help us with the how this per sliding barrel credit mechanism works. You know, if, when you go from 8 to 7 to 6 or what have you, is it weekly or monthly calculated, quarterly, annual, and then is there true ups or how do you deal with it when in the middle of a fiscal year when that you're in the middle of that staircase?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So we have a the production tax is an annual, it's kind of a high, it's an annual tax, but it has some monthly elements in it. So the sliding scale per taxable barrel credit is based on a monthly calculation. So each month a company is going to look at their wellhead value per barrel and generate a maximum amount of per taxable barrel credits for that month. And then they're going to, when they're making their monthly tax payment, they will they'll calculate this whole series of calculations on a monthly basis. At the end of the year, when they file their annual tax return in due on March 31st of the following year, there will be a true-up calculation where if the company had excess per taxable barrel credits that were not able to be applied in calculating their monthly installment payment, they would reconcile that when they file their annual tax return payment.
Okay. We have any other questions? We'll go to the next slide.
All right. Slide 16 is just a few other items that get added to the total production tax revenue received by the state in a given fiscal year. So this would be any prior year tax payments or refunds. We levy a tax on the value of private landowner royalty. Any tax revenue for North Slope gas production. Any net tax revenue from production in Cook Inlet. We have a conservation surcharge. That's an additional nickel per barrel of oil that's produced. And then we also, any other company-specific issues that cause the illustrative tax calculation to not exactly match out to our company-specific calculation. So for fiscal year 2024, the net sum of all of those other items is about $16.9 million. And so that then gets you to the total tax paid to the state as shown in the revenue sources book of $1,236.9 million. And all but about $8 million of that goes to the general fund. The $8 million of hazardous release surcharge, that's the nickel per barrel, we consider that designated general fund revenue in the revenue sources book. And also, before we move on to the next slide, at the very bottom here, for fiscal year 2024, we're forecasting another about $882 million of non-deductible lease expenditures that are expected to be earned and then become a carry forward that can be used to as a deduction for potentially future year taxes.
Okay, so no questions on this one. If you could add, maybe get back to the committee. We've got the, I'm a slide ahead of you. Sorry. I'll let you go to the next slide. I was just so excited about this next slide, I just turned it too early.
Couldn't wait.
Go ahead.
Sure. So slide 17 is the same analysis we've been walking through, but shown for a five-year spread. So we look at two historical years, the current year, and then two forecast years. You can see we have a production tax value ranging from about $3.5 billion in fiscal year 2021, increasing to over $8 billion in fiscal year 22 and 23, then expected at a little over $7 billion in fiscal year 2024 and a little over $6 billion in fiscal year 2025. And those correlate to changes in the expected total production tax revenue received by the state as well. We are expecting the net tax to be the higher of for all of the years shown on this chart and for the foreseeable future with the current oil price forecast. Call out two lines at the bottom that we added to this chart based on feedback from the committee last year. So we have a line showing the total estimated ending balance of those carried forward lease expenditures at the end of each fiscal year, and this shows the total deductions that would potentially be available for to offset future year tax calculations. And then we've also added the effective tax rate, and the effective tax rate represents the total tax paid to the state as a share of production tax value. And you'll see, given the various tax credits that we do have available, the effective tax rate is lower than the statutory 35% tax rate.
And then on this, could you get back to us also, because here we have the severance, and then if you could add, not so much for this presentation, but just back for the committee, the royalties, corporate income tax, and property tax, and then give us the government share percentage also. So that way everybody's not calculating it with different numbers. At least we'll have one set of numbers that when we want to have the conversations. Sometimes we have different numerics flying around. Nice to centralize those off of one data set.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that.
Okay.
So slide 18 is a little bit different take. This is a standalone illustration. Looks at what would the tax calculation look like if there was a single taxpayer for the North Slope. So right now we have multiple different companies doing business. They each calculate their tax liability independently, and then the state revenue is the aggregation. But what if there was only one taxpayer? And if there was only one taxpayer, we expect that they would be able to use the full $8 per barrel sliding scale tax credit against their tax liability. Right now, we assume that there are some smaller companies that are not able to use that full $8 per barrel tax credit. And the result of that would be that we'd expect total production tax into the Treasury to be about $1.19 billion, which is slightly lower than the $1.24 billion in the official forecast. Relatively minor differences at the forecasted oil price. The difference, if you had a little bit lower oil price where you had more companies shifting into the minimum tax, we'd expect a bigger difference between the aggregate calculation and the single taxpayer calculation, but still just highlights the fact that the tax has a different impact on each individual company since they have different portfolio of operations and investments.
Okay. Any other questions on this one? Senator Bishop.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to point out something. If we go back one slide, Mr. Stickle, 17, slide 17, total tax, total net to the state is $1.2 billion on the forecasted for 24. Total net to the state is what?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, so for fiscal year 2024, it's a little over $1.2 billion is our total production tax.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. I just want to go back, then you go back, you know, you don't have to go back there, but if you go back to slide six, our royalty is going to be about 1.7, right? About 1.7 billion on royalties to the treasury, to the permanent fund and the public school education trust fund and the other smaller fund. So there's three dedicated funds that royalties go into. Is that correct?
That's correct, Senator Bishop.
With a total to the treasury, both in UGF and dedicated funds of $3.4 billion.
That's correct.
Okay, so I just don't want the viewers to listen, get focused in on this slide and think we're only getting $1.2 billion to the treasury. We're getting more than that.
Yes, that's why it's important to add all four components. And remember, we have to recognize that some of those dollars in those components, property tax, and don't end up in the treasury of the state. They end up at the local level. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Royalties and property, our corporate income, property tax, royalties and property tax. And please, when you give us the data of the whole, the total revenue, include those amounts that go to the borough and the affected communities on the government sharing numeric. So we include all that. So we have one set of numbers that they float around the building. Everybody has the same set. So what I'm trying to accomplish.
Sure. Be happy to do that.
Especially due to, you know, with Senator Bishop's comment that some people get focused on one or two or three of the components. They don't look at the whole pot.
If I may, I believe we had wrapped up slide 18.
Yeah.
And then, so the next couple of slides are just some additional slides we included for the committee's benefit. Slide 19 is our all oil is not equal slide. This shows how state petroleum revenues vary by the type of land. So as we were discussing earlier, taxes apply to any oil produced in the state and within the state's 3-mile limit. And then there's different provisions for royalty depending on where the state or where the oil is produced. So the state receives all of the royalty for production on state lands. We receive a share of royalty for production on federal lands and within the states and offshore within 3 to 6 miles offshore. Once we get beyond the 6 miles offshore, were there to be any production in that area, the state would not receive any direct revenue from that production.
Next slide.
Slide 20 is just some additional bullet points regarding the gross value reduction. Talked about this a little bit when we were talking about the production tax value calculation. The gross value reduction, this was part of the Senate Bill 21 tax reform that was passed in 13, intended to provide a benefit for investments in new oil.
Okay, that second bullet, averaging over $70 per barrel for any 3 years, where are we at in that time frame on exclusions of termination of the gross value reduction?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So the gross value reduction is calculated for each field. So when a field comes into production, each field has a separate clock, so to speak, for their gross value reduction. And so the first potential year of those 70 years would, or $70 would begin when the field comes into production. So we do within our group, we maintain a schedule of all of the different fields that do qualify or potentially would qualify, and when those would potentially meet that three-year qualification. We do have some fields that graduated from the gross value reduction at the beginning of this calendar year. When the gross value reduction was enacted, certain fields that had recently come into production were grandfathered in to retain their gross value reduction provisions. So we do have some fields that are graduating this year, and then a forecast of when additional fields will graduate in the future.
Okay. Any other questions on gross value reduction? Okay. We'll go to 21.
Sure. And slide 21 and 22 are a rehash of slides that we presented the other day. But just to reiterate, the impact of different oil taxes on the tax system. So slide 21 is looking at a chart of unrestricted revenue for fiscal year 2024, excluding the permanent fund transfer, and how that would change with relation to oil price. You can see the official forecast is $3.4 billion of unrestricted general fund revenue compared to a oil price forecast of $81 per barrel. How this slide relates to the rest of the presentation is because the minimum tax and the sliding scale nature of the per barrel tax credits add a progressive element to the production tax and therefore to the fiscal system as a whole. So near the forecasted price, a $1 increase or decrease in oil prices equates to about a $70 million change in unrestricted general fund revenue. Once we get below about $70 per barrel of oil price, that's where some of the companies start to be governed by the minimum tax, anywhere in that $50 to $70 barrel per range. And then the incremental value to the state of each, or incremental change to the state of each dollar of oil is less than the $70 million. And then once we get above $90 per barrel oil is where you start to see that sliding scale in the per taxable barrel credit take effect. And then the incremental value to the state of each dollar change in oil prices is higher than the 70. And slide 22 just puts some of that information into table form, also includes fiscal years 25 and 26. This comes from Appendix A of the Revenue Sources book.
And help us with that a little bit. So when you do the sensitivity table, do you hold all else constant, just change price, or how does your sensitivity analysis work?
Mr. Chairman, when we're doing the sensitivity analysis, we hold the major assumptions constant. So we assume constant non-oil revenues. We assume a constant production level. We do apply an elasticity assumption to lease expenditures. So we assume that there will be some inflation to lease expenditures at higher oil prices and some deflation at lower oil prices. That's been consistent with what we've seen historically.
I'll get to you in just a minute. Just on that follow-up, that elasticity of expenditures, is that more applicable to multi-year or within 12 months?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So that's a great question. We're currently assuming an elasticity of 0.3. That comes from some academic literature, which suggests that a 10% increase in price would correspond to about a 3% increase in lease expenditures. There's going to be both short-term and long-term impacts of a price change. So short-term, if there's a price spike and a significant increase in drilling activity, the cost of accessing key supplies or contractor services might increase fairly quickly with increased demand from oil companies. Obviously, if you see a sustained increase or decrease in price relative to the forecast, you're going to start to see impacts on long-term operations costs and capital costs and things like that.
Okay. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickley, you talked about progressivity and this in the previous slide. And above 75 with some bumps, it looks a little flat. I can't do the math at the table. Could I ask you to get back to me or the committee with nominal effective rates across these price ranges?
Could you help me with the question?
The tax rates across these price ranges?
Effective tax rate, or
is that probably the nominal and the effective?
Right, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Sure. Absolutely.
Thanks.
Yeah. Any other questions for Stickle while we have him on the hot seat? Okay. Well, I'd like to thank the department for coming forward. And as another just brief note for those watching, we've had one of our consultants come in last several years and do some beginning level education for, you know, the building on oil tax structure and oil industry itself. And then they'd actually do a more advanced review over a couple of days. Well, that consultant has retired and is no longer available. So we're kind of trying within 2 hours to take some of that into account when we walk through the presentation today and cover some of the basics. And in need be, over the next couple of months, if we have to, you know, or if we delve into this in detail in some piece of legislation or what have you, or impacts, and we'll have Mr. Stickle in Department of Revenue and come back in and we'll go into more detail. So today was just kind of replicating, I guess, a little bit of what we don't have from our consultants anymore. And LBNA, I'm sure, will be looking at that subject over the next few months and trying to come up with how we're going to replace that, because I think it's been, that education's been very valuable to the legislature and to our employees within the legislature, because they do a lot of the work, and it's important that the legislative aides understand the system also, what they're dealing with. So with that, that concludes today. Again, thank you, Ms. Stickle. Thanks, Ms. Glover. She has been online as your trustee backup, but as mentioned to you before you started, I didn't feel you would need a lifeline, which you didn't at all. So that is no surprise to the committee. So next week, or the next meeting will be next week at Monday. We will not have a meeting Friday. On Monday, we're most likely going to be taking up the supplemental budget, which is the budget changes for this current fiscal year recommended by the governor administration. So we'll take a look at that. We'll also be posting by or 4 o'clock or shortly thereafter today the rest of the schedule next week. But we'll be here at 9 a.m. Monday morning, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, to start with the budget. We are adjourned.